Hello and welcome to recording number 18 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 14th, 2021. Last recording, there was some confusion about distances and such, and I'm sure that, you know, if Gygax had done a map, maybe we would, you know, it would be less confusing than what we ran into yesterday. My biggest problem with what was being said was Omni's group, for 10 days or more, managed to outdistance Gord, Geller, and Greenleaf as they pursued him, and I found that a little unlikely. It's also that they were instructed by us to go to Verbabank. And once out of Verbabank, then they were to go and set a trail so that Omni could leave and leave behind the rest of his band with Gleed and so act as a false trail for the artifact. And he sent them off to the Hierarch area. And he himself, of course, is a servant of Uz, so that's where he was going to head with Keek. They actually ran into Melf, who didn't know. Now, outside Littleburg, Gord and Geller and their band of six, they encountered the pilgrims that Omni's band had massacred and found two survivors, a little boy and a little girl, who did inform them of Omni and Keek's name. So if they do run across them, they will know who they are. If they're still foolishly using their own names. All right, I am going to restart. Today it is page 168 and the final paragraph. Gord hunkered down in his traveling cloak. It would be a wonderful place to see, I'm sure, if this filthy rain would ever cease, he grumbled. The water was high. Another wayfarer remarked, but the ford was no real problem. And soon the six men were on the eastern side of the At, their horses plodding through the sheets of precipitation. The rain soon became torrential, and despite the best efforts of Geller and the Druid, they lost their way. Knowing that there was no hope of continued pursuit under such conditions, they decided to halt early that day, and spent a miserable twilight and night in a wet encampment. Bad weather persisted, but they slogged ahead through the progressively more deserted and wild countryside. Although the terrain was predominantly flat, there were swampy patches and many small ponds and lakes, fed and drained by streamlets and creeks. Rocky outcroppings and knobby hills thrust up here and there from the plain. The scarcity of trees in the area was from a poor, acidic soil, rather than from the clearing of timber for lumbering or agriculture. Break. So, I'm breaking right here, because we're getting a nice description of the lands of Furiundi, east of the At River near Littleburg. Now, Gygax decide, there's a place called Broadford, which is supposed to be about 10 miles north of Littleburg, and that is where they cross. And from there, the east is supposed to be a little wild, and it's also swampy and wild countryside, predominantly flat with swamp patches, small ponds and lakes, fed and drained by streamlets and creeks, probably, you know, coming off of the At River. There are rocky outcroppings and knobby hills, and very few trees. And it says, because the soil is acidic. Now, that would probably explain why there isn't farmland around here. Besides being maybe too swampy for most crops, it's also bad soil. So here we have the crossing, but then the eastern area here is and this is quite in the center of Furiundi, is a bad patch of land right here. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 169 and the fourth paragraph. "See yon woodlands, curly greenleaf said with a cheerful note in his voice. With sun and trees, I think our fortune is changing for the better." "The land here is different," Keller agreed, "and I believe we are nearing the Vang." The six horsemen were moving along the narrow, rutted track that wound its way to the only fording place shown on the bard's map. The Vang was a broad and deep river, and there was little commerce with the land to the north, thus the condition of the road and the lack of habitation. A sudden movement caught Inkosi's attention. "I saw a figure, a man, I think," the Flan warrior called out softly to the rest. Although Inkosi did not point or give any indication of where he had seen movement, Gord had seen his head move. The young thief was keen-eyed and quick-witted. Without seeming to scan the area, Gord did so, and then added to Inkosi's report, "There are armed men and probably women, too," he said. "I saw the glint of metal, and a flash of bright skirt as well." Geller didn't turn as he called back to them. "Make no motion or gesture that indicates our sighting," he told the others. "Ride on as if you were totally unaware of these skulkers. When we hit the trees, we'll dismount and work to the left." So I'm breaking right here. And again, there's a little bit more information about the area around Furiondi. So between the At and the Vang, it has been mostly bad terrain. And now, as they're getting closer to the terrain, they're seeing woodlands. And Geller notes that the land is different. But at the same time, its nearness to the hierarchs shows there's little trade. And it's only a rough road, a rough dirt rutted road that leads its way east to the crossing of the Vang. Which, if you were reading, the Melf partition, that was called Boulder Ford, the area that Melf was looking over and which Gleed and the rest of Obmi's band was headed. Now, Boulder Ford in this book is just a ford. There are no buildings or fortifications on either side of the river. So from the context of what they're saying, it seems like Furiondi and the hierarchs are maintaining some kind of peace between the border of the Vang River right here, because I would have expected there to be more patrols and some kind of fortification near the ford. Even if the two don't get aren't at war, I still am surprised that there isn't more guard against what the hierarchs are doing. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 170 and the second paragraph. The six were soon screened by the trees of the small woods that the road cut through. Although the patch of trees and scrub was no more than 200 yards wide, it ran for about double that distance lengthwise. The hidden group had been near the end of the western verge of the woods. It was obvious that they sought secrecy, not an opportunity to ambush the riders. The other adventurers followed Geller's example, dismounting quickly and leading their mounts through the growth. The ground was relatively free of underbrush here, for the trees were large and had heavy foliage, oaks, maples, and a few towering usks. After a short distance, the bard and the druid gave over their animals to Patrick and Moon, telling Inkosi and Gord to do likewise. Break. All right, now here's mention of the usk tree, and I believe it is a native, Greyhawk campaign tree rather than, unless, I'm not an expert on trees, so it could be a real-world tree, but I believe it is a tree native to the Greyhawk campaign. So we have a little description of the woods that they're encountering. And this is the first even a small growth of woodland that they've seen coming from the At River. And so it's composed of oaks, maples, and usks. Now, I would suspect that with Geller, with Greenleaf and Geller along, they'd know exactly. You can kind of trust Geller's description here. And, you know, we're always talking about unreliable narrators, but both Geller and Curly are very familiar with woodlands. Curly Greenleaf is a druid ranger, so I would definitely try. This is why I always miss it when Chris can't make a night. So I don't know if there... Oh, sounds. Sometimes there is a little error either with my laptop or Craig and I lose sound. So just that little bit there, sound was lost. Let's see where I was, and I'm going to restart. All right. I'm starting. I'm just going to restart here. It's page 170, paragraph 3. "Stay here with the mounts," commanded the one-eyed bard, "but be ready to come at my whistle or our call." Patrick nodded, and he and his fellow mercenary moved to an open space near the edge of the woods as the other four members of the party moved stealthily ahead. "Hist! There are a dozen people just ahead," said Greenleaf, as he suddenly appeared before Gord and the Flan fighting man. "Geller and I will move right and left. You two wait a minute, and then advance as quietly as deer to the edge of the clearing they are in. Move straight ahead and be ready for combat." Inkose gave his mirthless smile and hefted his barbed spear meaningfully. Gord said nothing but drew forth his sling. The half-elven druid disappeared, demonstrating his ranger skills as he did so. "Fighting elves in such country would be bad enough," Inkosi said softly, "but such as the Round One there are worse still. I think this band of hidden folk ahead are in big trouble if they prove to be enemies." Gord agreed. "This fighting is of the sort which Geller and Curly are most adept at. I prefer streets and alleys." The Flan warrior winked, and Gord grinned back. The time for waiting was about up, and they crept forward with almost no betraying noise. The pair crouched as they worked their way up a slight ridge, then fell prone as they reached its crest. The area on the other side was an open meadow, about 50 feet in diameter. In the clearing were horses, men, and a group of dishevelled women in the process of picking up bundles. Their attitudes and the watchful men nearby indicated that they were captives, not companions of the rough-looking lot. The two men watched unseen for several minutes, and Inkosi looked at Gord questioningly, for the group was preparing to leave the clearing with a handful of mounted men leading the way, and the female prisoners and their burdens ringed by another half-dozen or so men on foot. "Do we attack?" he asked the young thief softly. Gord shook his head. "Wait for Geller or Greenleaf to act," he replied as quietly. Just as the brigands were moving out of the clearing toward the south, a one-eyed bard appeared suddenly and stood arms akimbo, barring the path of the horsemen. "Hold there," he cried. "Throw down your arms and surrender, or you shall be the sorrier." The demand was certainly loud enough for Moon and Patrick to hear, and Gord knew that the two fighters would soon come to the support of their fellows. Meanwhile, he wondered what was Geller planning. He dashed to a position behind a nearby oak, and Nkosi took a similar station even closer to the group, while the brigand's attention was fixed on the bearded man, who had so mysteriously appeared before them. "What?" the evident leader of the band cried, reining his horse so that it danced and pranced sideways. "Who are you, jackanapes, to demand anything?" Geller pointed with his left arm, indicating the edge of the little glen. "Observe, lout," he countered, and, as he spoke, a great thicket of briars and brambles sprang into being so as entirely seal off the western edge of the place. "I am a patient man, but this sloth begins to pall. Get off those horses and throw down your weapons now." All right, break. I want to note, now here we're getting a description of what is, I think, obviously the remains of Abmi's band, the ones who had escaped with the female prisoners. Now, one of the things that makes me note is that they're all, the women are all on foot. So again, I'm wondering how it took Gord and their group to take this much time to encounter them. Now, these prisoners, they should have been started to be rounded up after Abmi left Verbabank, where he was instructed by Uz to go back to his normal pillaging and killing. So, in 10 days after that, it managed to avoid encountering Gord and Geller. And I just think there's something really off here, something missing, perhaps, about why it has taken the mounted six of Gord, Geller, Patrick, and Kosi and Moon so long to catch up with Abmi, who is not only has carts full of loot, but since leaving Verbabank, has traveled probably about 150, 160 miles north to Littleburg, and definitely has these, captives with him, probably a growing band of captives as he's raiding north. And I just think he's stopping, he's raiding, he's taking prisoners and loot, and having people on foot and wagons to bring. I think there is just a problem that Gygax needed to add something that would have slowed down Geller and Gord and the Six. So I just feel like there's a little something missing there. In the thought process of writing this right here. This business, it's just a little note here, but we do see that the women captives are on foot. And I really think that, they should have caught up with them previously. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 171 and the final paragraph. The crossbowmen among the unmounted brigands were moving slowly, so as to be able to fire at this lone adversary. Left unwatched, the dozen or so women and girls began to move backwards. A gap between captors and captives was developing rapidly, Gord saw, and he realized that this was what Geller and Greenleaf had desired to accomplish. Just then, the captain of the band gave a battle shout and spurred his steed ahead directly at the one-eyed bard. Break. All right, on page 172, we get a picture of the captain of the brigands on his mount, confronting who I believe is Curly. Well, No, I'm wrong. Definitely, I guess, a bandit confronting someone. But Curly's bald. And I'm not sure who that's supposed to be right there. Maybe it's Geller. Yeah, you know, so maybe I'm mistaken. Oh, it is Geller. All right, and I don't know. I didn't believe Geller had stepped up, and it was supposed to be a lone figure. That the captain was confronting. All right. Yeah, and all right. I guess Geller did, because it says that in the previous paragraph that he charged directly at the one-eyed bard. All right, so that's Geller standing there, and that's the captain. Looks like he's got some kind of falchion there, although the drawing's a little on the indistinct side of details. So I'm going to restart. It's page 173 and the second paragraph. "Die!" screamed the beefy brigand, slashing at Geller with a heavy falchion and rearing his horse so as to make it flail with its forehooves. Geller merely stepped in close, darting to the left side of the frenzied animal. "Fall!" he bellowed in reply to the brigand as he grabbed the man's left leg, jerked it from the stirrup, and heaved. The surprised brigand flew up and backward to land with a jarring thud. His horse screamed and galloped off. Geller stood once again with arms akimbo before the prancing mounts of the four remaining horsemen. Gord saw that the arbalists were almost in position to bring their weapons to bear upon his comrade. "Now we must show ourselves," he called to Nkosi. As the two stood forth from behind the trees on the little ridge, they made sufficient noise to draw attention to themselves. The captives saw them first, dropped their bundles, and fled eastward, away from the brigands confronting Geller. This seemed to serve as a signal for Greenleaf to act. He appeared at the far edge of the clearing, and the frightened escapees swirled left and right around him, shrieking in alarm. All this commotion caused the outlaws to spin and look to their flank and rear. A quarrel buzzed past Gord and embedded itself in the oak beside the Flan warrior. Suddenly, Geller's sword was out and flashing. A rider who had turned his head at the distraction uttered a howl of pain as the blade bit into his arm. The flail he had formerly held ready fell to the turf, and the wounded brigand's horse ran into another animal and kicked at a second. All was now total chaos. Break. All right. Again, something I'm just a little... And it's my fault. My fault right here. I mistook the character confronting them as the druid, when right from the start it is Geller who confronts them. The one-eyed bard appeared suddenly and stood arms akimbo. So yes, so I was mistaken right there. That was Geller and not Curly. So that all makes sense right there. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 173. And the third paragraph from the end. "I saw him hurl something," said Nkosi with a grunt of effort, as he heaved his spear at a charging big brigand. Gord replied as he let fly an egg-sized stone at the same time. "The druid uses fire seeds. He told me of the magic." Both adventurers were drawing their short swords, even as they exchanged more comments. They dispatched the wounded brigand and ran to engage the others below. As Gordon and Nkosi charged down the gentle slope, Patrick and Moon burst from the trees, urging their horses to a trot, and another of the druid's enchanted missiles sent forth its fiery tongues. This was all too much for the outlaws. Those on foot Four dismounted, threw down their weapons, and cried for quarter. Two horsemen managed to get past the bard's whirling sword, however, and rode away without concern for their fellows. "Ride them down," Geller boomed to the two mounted mercenaries. "Bring them back, alive or dead." Boone and his companion complied immediately, and likewise disappeared into the trees in pursuit. The four other adventurers rounded up the surviving brigands. There were 10 in all, 8 of them wounded, and 4 of those near death. Only 2 of the opponents had been killed. Greenleaf actually ministered to the mortally injured outlaws, and in a few minutes it was clear that they would now survive their wounds. "What about those prisoners?" Gord called. "They won't wander far in the next quarter hour," the half-elven druid replied as he finished his healing work. "Moon and Patrick should be back by then, and we'll have this lot ready for a march. We'll all go after those women and find out how they came to be captives of this lot." Geller eyed the cowed brigands coldly. "Pray they condemn you not, or your deaths will be hard. Have any of you anything to say?" Gord and Okosi were just finishing binding the hands of the outlaw prisoners when Patrick and Moon returned. They bore red badges of battle, but behind them they led the horses of the two brigands who had attempted to escape. The bodies of the pair were slung across their steed saddles. The prisoners got one look at this and began a flood of confessions, explanations, and pleas. A few kicks and shakes silenced the babble, and then organized questioning began. The bound outlaws were frog-marched one at a time to stand alone and tell what they knew to Geller. This was done out of sight and earshot of the rest. After each brigand was finished with, he was taken to a place in the woods. Gord stood guard over these men as they came. The outlaws, not knowing the fate of their comrades, spoke progressively more factually, and to the point. After the 7th man of the 10 was questioned, Geller had the full picture. All right, break. Now, this is just a little note about the battle here. Now, Geller is able to disarm the flail using horsemen. Now, I'm not sure what Gygax is doing right here. It's not normally the kind of thing you would find in regular AD&D combat. So it's either something that is done for the story, or else Gygax is starting to use, like critical hits right here, or called shots where you can actually target, an arm or a specific part of the body. So that to me, that it's not exactly the way the combat would normally go in AD&D, but at this point, there's a lot of supplemental stuff that's been out in Dragon Magazine and Unearthed Arcana, so there's quite a few books out that, and a lot of ideas that were swirling around TSR at the time, which eventually led to, second edition. But, in otherwise, it was coming out in supplemental books. I'm going to restart right here. And we are on page 175, paragraph 2. "Gord," called the bard, "bring the lot of dogs back to the clearing." The young thief quickly herded the sullen group of brigands back to join their fellows, and Geller spoke to the entire group. "I know that you served with the vile dwarf Obni and his henchman Keek, the elf, and Gleed the gnome," the one-eyed man said to the prisoners. The brigands stood defiantly now. "I also know that you slew and burned, looted and raped from the far side of the Sus Forest all the way to here. These deeds are sufficient for your death warrants, each and every one of you." The sullen faces were more pale after this statement, but there was no other reaction. Geller went on, as much for the benefit of his associates as for other reasons. "The ambush and destruction of your former company is none of our doing," said the bard, "but I applaud those who brought your band so low. Now ready yourselves. We will find the prisoners who fled from you and tell them they are free. You will run before us, and woe to any who stumble, for they will not rise again. Thereafter you will serve as our shield as we seek other survivors of your foul band. Break. All right, that's an interesting thing, where he's going to use them as a little beating force out there ahead of them. Now, I wanted to make mention, because I was thinking about this, but it slipped my mind briefly, is that when Patrick and Moon return, Gygax says that they bore red badges of battle, which I think everybody should understand just means that in their confrontation, they were both wounded. You know, like the Red Badge of Courage novels that, you know, a bloody wound is a sign of courage, a sign of fighting.
Yeah, they were bloodied but not bowed.
Yes, and, you know, it is interesting that Patrick and Moon were not, you know, were not able to just kill these two bandits outright, that they, in the actual fight, they were both wounded. And yes, as it says, archaic terminology. And, yeah, it's something, again, that isn't, there's a lot of terminology that is not used anymore. I have a book somewhere of all the little terminology from World War One, which is, you know, there's enough unique commentary and statements and stuff, so that I always kind of miss it. And I'm always looking for it in these Greyhawk books, is to gather up, you know, various terms that you can interject into the campaign, like I spit on the old one and such. That's a particularly nice one.
I like their interrogation technique too, where they kept the people apart from each other so that, like, no one heard what the other one was saying.
Yes, that, you know, that's something that took a long time for you know, the police science to come to realize that you don't want to have them there supporting each other and hearing what the other one said. I mean, then they can just agree, or, you know, it's very important in interrogation not to have them all together and such. And also, by removing them, they don't know what's, you know, going to happen to them.
Yeah, knowing that they're so obviously evil, they probably think the worst.
Definitely, because you can see that Gygax, in this book, he definitely has a caricature of evil. They're generally petty, pompous. Even if they have intelligence, they don't seem to have wisdom. And even the ones with wit who should have wisdom, they still show this lack of character. They're almost always willing to turn on their own side. It is, you know, I personally don't play that way. I don't run the villains all as behaving so much so as we've seen in all these different kinds, like all the way back from what was his name, the Beggar Master, all the way Theobald. Yes, all the way from Theobald to Uz to Obmi, you know, to Gleed, where they're all willing to turn on each other, and they're, you know, there's, you know, it is showing that they have this, not just a moral weakness, they have that, but the evil characters also show, they just show this variety of different weak characteristics that aren't, you know, I'm just surprised all the time that there isn't, that it is kind of so commonplace.
All right. The thing that Geller did with the human shield, I mean, that's not a good thing. I mean,
well, no, but it definitely Geller and Curly are neutrals. So right. They're not necessarily going to be good. So I think what the thing with the neutrals in this story is that they are expedient. You know, they do whatever is necessary, and I'm even surprised that they're going to help out the female captives, because they seem to be in such a rush, and they've done it before, where they have not done what, say, like, you know, like a good character would normally do. Now, if you look back to Deirdre and Oscar, where they felt that they had to act for the good, and definitely not neutral characters, at least Deirdre, and she felt she had to act for the good when this force of probably Blanc and Scarlet Brotherhood and monsters and humanoids that they've gathered up were fighting across the Whelkwood. You know, she felt that they needed to go and deal with that. And even though she should realize how important it is to get this artifact, you know, she felt that the immediate good was stronger, and why she and Oscar left. The immediate good was more important than a good that was down the road. So we do see, you know, Gygax has taken alignments, and he not only has them as a game mechanic, but as we saw, he used, in this book, expressed them as philosophies, so that you would have a chaotic evil philosophy within the campaign, so that, you know, these people were not just acting in the way of alignments as part of the game mechanics. They're actually, chaotic evil actually describes a philosophy that is occurring within the story. So, yeah, you know, it's where they are kind of keeping everything within these certain boundaries, and we do see the actions of Gord and Geller and Curly not straight in with what would be, you know, what be a philosophy that would be called good. So it is, you know, it is a little off from what you'd see in a regular fantasy hero kind of novel.
Yeah, I think it's good that he's showing them as like a potentially neutral character would how they would act.
Yes, and I mean these are part of the things that are good about the book. If you want to go with that, then these are very good examples of how you could role play them, or as a DM add these characteristics. You know, with the alignment system, how they could be expressed within the game itself, not just as a mechanic. And by mechanic, you know, I mean, if you have spells that are like protection from good, protection from evil, and they're meaning very specific things, the way they're described in the game mechanics about affecting characters of that alignment or monsters of that alignment. And so alignment is a really, it is an important part of the mechanics of the game to allow the functioning of certain magic items and spells where the alignment plays an actual issue. So, all right. I'm going to restart on page 175. It is Paragraph 5. The sullen faces were more pale after this statement, but there was no other reaction. Geller went on, as much for the benefit of his associates as for other reasons. "The ambush and destruction of your former company is none of our doing," said the bard, "but I applaud those who brought your band so low. Now ready yourselves. We will find the prisoners who fled from you, and tell them they are free. You will run before us, and woe to any who stumble, for they will not rise again. Thereafter, you will serve as our shield, as we seek other survivors of your foul band." The druid had rounded up the horses, numbering 11 now, with the addition of those of the brigands, which were standing quietly with the coursers ridden by the adventurers. The six mounted, weapons unsheathed and ready. Trotting before them went the half-score outlaws, their hands thong securely behind their backs. Just as they left the wooded area, however, they saw the former captives running toward them. The northern sky was dark, and an inky black cloud stained the horizon. "Help! Help!" the women cried as they approached. A dozen giant ravens wheeled and croaked above the women. but something far worse had brought them to such a state of panic. "We are friends," called the druid. "Your former captives are now our prisoners. How can we help?" There was no hesitation. The dozen women and girls came directly up to the party, ignoring the brigands, who had been herded into a clump by Moon and Nkosi. Gord noted that although they were dirty and worn, the former captives were all well-formed and good-looking. Prime candidates for slavery indeed, the young thief thought. One of their number shouted for silence and spoke to Greenleaf. "Gaunt horses come at us, druid, and terrible baying from inside the black mists. The riders are inhuman, and the calls send terror to the marrow of the bone. These are Yeth-hounds." How she knew of these fell creatures, Greenleaf couldn't guess, but what she said seemed true enough. He gestured toward the riderless horses. "Each of these spare mounts will carry two of you," he said to the spokeswoman. "You will ride with me, and the girl," he continued, pointing to a frail brunette, hardly more than a child, "rides behind that man there, Gord." The frightened females complied readily. Gord said nothing, merely smiled, and extended a hand to help her up. "Your friends approach, I think," Geller called to the 10 brigands. "Run to greet them, or else we will ride you down and slay you all here and now." Two of the outlaws cried for mercy, and several others demanded to have their hands freed and be given a weapon. A few blows with spear butt and sword flat silenced these pleadings and demands. The brigands began trotting away toward the gathering gloom. Unwilling but afraid of the threat of instant death, the party sat for a moment watching the men. When one started to turn back, Nkosi leveled a spear and brought his horse forward to a trot. The brigand swerved and began loping toward the black fog again. His fellows likewise began running. Nkosi turned his mount, and the whole party went away down the trail at a canter. As they moved, Gord shouted to his fellows, "There are worse than the Yeth-hound in that doom. Hades has unleashed its whole pack." "What? How know you this?" Geller called back with doubt. "I could see into the blackness," Gord replied emphatically. "How, I know not. But the vision was as clear as if I saw through eagle eyes. It was so close." "Never mind how," interrupted Greenleaf. "What did you see?" The young thief grimly described his vision. "Many of the things I saw were unknown to me. Great and malign creatures of foul aspect. I saw three men on night gaunts. That name sprang into my brain as if placed there. They were the chiefest of the hierarchs. Around them swarmed the hounds of Hades, Yeth, and more deadly dogs still. Hags and hulking giants marshaled a host of hobgoblins and lesser humanoids in their thousands. All were poised to march at the hierarch's command. Ravens and bats are the scouts and messengers of this evil horde, and they report our proximity even now." "This is fearsome news," said the druid, "but your seeing was certainly granted to you by some power opposed to these hideous minions of Hades." "What else did you see?" demanded Geller, looking fixedly at Gord as they rode. Gord met the one-eyed bard's piercing gaze. The centermost of the three hierarchs pointed southwest. The other two gestured. "I saw dragon-hide drums being beaten, and I felt the rumble through the very ground. On the other hand, iron horns were winded, and the ebon vapors seethed and billowed at the bellowing. They are advancing, but they seek something to the west of us. If we ride due south, we will avoid this terrible horde." The others had heard the whole exchange. All looked at Geller to see his reaction. He was silent for a minute, then spoke. "We will follow this track until the women are safe. Then Patrick and his friend Moon will escort them onward. The rest of us will turn westward and ride to the coming battle, for more than our lives depend on it." Break. That's page 177 and the end of chapter 16. Chris has put up the Greyhawk Adventures Yeth Hound. I think that's from, is it from a Monstrous Compendium?
Yeah, MC5.
All right, so it's a little later. Now, it's interesting. I don't know, this may be one of the earliest mentions of a Yeth Hound. We also have Night Gaunts, which there are now three Hierarchs here, according to Gord's vision, and they're riding Night Gaunts. And this horde sounds unstoppable with hags and hulking figures and thousands of hobgoblins. So now we know from previously that what is to the west is probably Melf and company being attacked by the greater demon or daemon from Hades. And so he is with Chert and Biff and Lizard there, who are stuck and have been over, you know, the terror in the black ebon vapors has overcome them. And although they tried stopping it with walls of force, it wasn't enough. And the last thing we heard from Melf was that they were getting ready to fight to the death. So now we have the two groups look like they're about to come upon each other. And I note that Patrick and Moon, who seem to be, that they were mercenaries, and I think definitely never of the level. I kind of think they're probably like mid-level mercenaries and not, you know, too much. There is an encounter table with the F-Hounds. Was that MC5 as well, or Chris has put up?
Yeah, I looked for a page number. I'm getting this out of the encyclopedia from Greyhawk.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, and so it's so. You know, when we look at the Yeth Hound, it's kind of got the it's kind of got the body of something more leonine than doggish. And it's got a face that looks a little bit human, according to this illustration. So anyway, Patrick and Moon are going to escort the women prisoners, because I don't think Gord or Geller or Curly think they're up to this kind of level of a fight, and there would be no real way to save the female prisoners otherwise. All right.
Yeah, some really evil stuff they're up against.
Yes, and not even of us. These are the Hierarchs. And I guess this is what they have aiding them. So we can see that the Hierarchs, they are summoning up great powers. I don't know if any of these are a match for us or his upper-level, upper-level servants. Because Uz himself is, you know, is a demigod, so he's much more powerful than I think what they're summoning up here.
No, demigod is not as powerful as a god, right?
Oh yeah. You know, there are like these hero deities.
Demigod.
Yeah, there's demiurges, demigods, and such. Now, I had thought that Cuthbert was the demigod and Uz.
He's a lesser god.
Lesser. Oh, no. Cuthbert's a lesser god.
Yeah. And I remember because I looked it up last time.
All right. So Uz is a demigod. Cuthbert's a lesser god. So they're not quite evenly matched. I think Uz is more powerful. But again, Uz. Now, the thing about Uz and Cuthbert is that they both appear on Earth without avatars. So they are both here in person, wielding more power than an avatar normally can deal. So although Uz certainly isn't as powerful as Grast, his father, he does have powerful allies, and he, like his mother Yggdrasil, and also Zuckmoy, who would be here as an avatar. You know, as being present on Earth, it does make him one of the most powerful creatures on all of Earth. All right, I am going to restart here. It is chapter 16, page 179, first paragraph. Blue Selene showed only her slender crescent high above amidst the myriad icy-colored lights that sprinkled the vast welkin in a crystalline wonder. The air was soft and warm, and the breeze smelled of night-flowering blooms and growing herbs. Across a prairie meadow dimly lit by the glimmerings of the heavens walked four men, leading tired horses. The extended wing of the eldest griffin pointed behind them to their left. From their occasional pauses to check this constellation, it was evident that the four were guided in their course by the stars. They traveled a little south of west, walking rapidly despite the lateness of the hour. All right, break. So now I don't know where we get. Blue Selene, of course, is the larger of the two moons of Earth. And now this is a nice little bit of description here of the area, which last we saw they were in Furiondi. And the term Elbis Griffin, I believe, is a constellation in the sky. So something for our friends who like Spelljammer right here. So we have the eldest griffin constellation. I don't know if it is or where it is mentioned again. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 179 and the second paragraph. Rest, Geller told the others. The druid heaved a grateful sigh, for the rotund half elf was exhausted from traveling and spell working. Gord, 20 years his junior, was too proud to utter any sound of relief, but he was just as glad for the pause. The wiry Flan warrior bringing up the rear seemed to stride on long, tireless legs. Inkosi merely grunted acknowledgement, allowed the reins he held to drop, and sat squatting on his heels. His steed began grazing, with its three fellows, snorting in pleasure as it tore mouthfuls of the dewy grass and consumed them. All right, I'm breaking here because I think we know, we're given Greenleaf's age here, who is around 20 years older than Gord. I think that's the first time that their relatives' ages are mentioned. Although Gord was, you know, so young at their first meeting, or relatively young, that you imagine that Geller and Greenleaf were older. All right. I'm going to restart. It is the second paragraph from the end of page 179. How long? Asked Gord. Geller spoke in a low voice. 15 minutes, a half hour, if our pudgy friends insist. But no longer, he answered. Those we seek to aid cannot be far distant. We are bound to do our utmost to find them. Whoever they are, added Greenleaf, as he stretched himself on the ground, and placed his hands behind his head. At least we are not pursued by the Yeth and their foul masters, Gord noted. So there is much hope. Gurley Greenleaf harumphed. Not for those we seek. They have no such luxury, I fear. And if we should find them, we must be prepared to face this malign enemy. Quiet, you two. Who knows what might be listening? Geller was nervous and edgy to speak thus, and the three with him understood and refrained from comment thereafter. Ord was dozing, a catnap where full alertness was but an eye blink away. Greenleaf hummed between meditation and snore. Inkosi had fallen into instant slumber. Only the one-eyed bard remained fully alert. His touch brought Gord to the instant alertness. The young thief saw at once that Geller had doffed his eye patch, and his enchanted ocular glittered in the place where his normal eye had once been. Look, there to the west, just above the horizon, he urged in a whisper. What do you see? Let me hold my sword, Gormr answered quietly, reaching for the Diomard weapon. Geller's hand gripped his own. No, just use your unaided vision, just as you did when you saw into the gloom yesterday. Tell me if you notice anything. Gord moved uneasily and peered into the sky, scanning the area by his friend. After a moment, he said, "I see nothing." "Wait, there are bats, scores of giant bats. They're flying northward in a stream." As he spoke, his whisper rose to a louder tone as excitement overcame the young thief. "More," prompted the bard. Greenleaf was awake and listening now, as was the Flan fighter. "Yes, there is something huge and terrible toward which they fly, but I can't look at it. It's like coals searing my eyes," Gord gasped. "You must look. Tell us what it does, this monstrous abomination." And as Geller said that he said that, he placed his palms reassuringly upon Gord's shoulders. Gord forced his eyes to the spot again. "It is a winged behemoth of Hades," choked the young adventurer. "Upon its back is one whose name must not be spoken, the master of the hierarchs. The winged horror is horrible, and its rider is worse." "As I feared," Geller said to his friends. "Yet even my enchanted orb revealed but little of this to me. Let us pray that the power you have to see such evil things will help us to combat them. Gather yourselves and prepare to fight those creatures from the pits." Without speaking, each of the four made swift preparation. The druid handed Gord two unusually heavy acorns, saying, "The oak and contination schooled me in certain special arts. These dear acorns are still potent, and will remain so for some hours yet. Cast them truly with your sling, comrade." Gord tucked the pair of missiles in his pouch and thanked the druid. "As surely as I can, old friend, and with a supplication too." To the horses moved well enough. A half hour of rest and grazing had refreshed them somewhat, but they couldn't be run hard without risk of killing them, whether from fall or exhaustion. As they rode at a slow trot, Gord considered his course in the coming engagement. First he would try the fireseed missiles given him by the druid, for they were potent. Thereafter he thought he would put aside his sling. He had no supply of magic bullets to employ, and against opponents such as those he had somehow seen, ordinary missiles of lead or stone would be useless. What then? Sword and dagger were good enough against most opponents, but Gord thought he'd find scant use for his blades. Not immediately, anyway. Only at the last. At that thought he could not suppress a shudder. "Think, man," he commanded himself. And I'm going to break here. It's page 181. We're getting near the end of the night. I wanted to comment some on what we've read. So we now have four of the hierarchs in this band, but I don't believe they're actually numbered. You know, we don't know how many hierarchs of the Horn Society there are, but the fourth one that they've now seen is riding upon this monstrous creature from Hades, and he is the head, the master of the hierarchs. So I don't know. Now, one thing in first edition AD&D and the way the setting was written, there are not super high-level characters. Mordenkainen himself started out, I believe, at like 9th or 10th level when he was considered very powerful. And, you know, if we look over the setting material, most of the highest-powered NPCs in the setting, I believe even in the 83 box set, they're still only about 14th to 16th level. So the master of the hierarchs, now he may even be listed under the 83 set of what the Horn Society is to tell you what level he is, but I'm sure, you know, he is of sufficiently high level to put to a test even these eight characters. Now we know Melf is a superior character. He's high level in both fighter and magic user. Chur is definitely a high level barbarian. Now I don't know about Biff and Lizard. Now out of this group of four, we've got three very strong ones. We've got Geller and Curly Greenleaf and Gord. And I am not sure how strong Inkosi is. Now He seems to be a more powerful figure than Patrick or Moon. But so there are three really unknowns. So we're going to have eight characters coming up against this monstrous creature of Hades and the master of the Hierarchs. And, you know, it's one of those big encounters where it was super powerful and lots of magical protection and abilities. So I'm really looking to see what the fight is going to be like. All right, it's 7 o'clock. I'm going to call up Craig and end it for tonight.